All right, guys. So, quick intro to today's podcast. What we have for you here today is actually an unlocked episode from over on the Patreon feed. Thus far in 2021, we have been consistently able to get out Wednesday episodes here on the main feed and Saturday episodes over at patreon.com/DomandColin. So, quick plug for that. Can't hurt. This is an episode from a few weeks ago that is covering the history of day 38 boots on Survivor, whatever that may entail. As we'll get into, spoiler alert, the evolution of day 38 boots has certainly been a noticeable one as we have gone from the final two era to the final three era into the final four fire making challenge era. Doesn't that still feel really good and natural to talk about? So that is what we have for you here today. Unfortunately, life just got in the way and we could not get out a brand new episode, but this is going to be certainly new stuff for the vast majority of people hearing me right now. But if you would like more of these bonus episodes, there are many at this point from which to choose over at patreon.com/DomandColin, and furthermore, full rewatches of Heroes versus Villains, China, Fiji, Guatemala, Big Brother 7, Big Brother 10. I'm probably missing some other stuff along the way there. And then in the year 2021, weekly episodes just covering the same sort of things that we do here on the main feed. But this is one of them. Hope you guys enjoy it. That's it from me right now. Let's send it to the actual episode. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are yet again in the Patron Zone. Dom, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing very well. Excited to be back here and eager to dive into today's topic at hand, which is bubbling the finals. And just for anyone unclear, it probably is worth flagging up. By bubbling the finals, I think this is a fairly commonly understood term, but what we mean is the person who just misses out on either the final two or final three, whatever the case may be. And today we're going to talk through, at least in passing, I think, all of the people who have held that distinction. But Dom, before we get into the specifics, I do think it is pertinent to flag up that bubbling the finals, or the way in which one bubbles the finals, has evolved pretty substantially over the years.
Yeah, and I think what you call it is an interesting question right at the outset, because for as important as this role in a season is, and as important as most of the people who have filled it have been to those seasons, there isn't a clear consensus over what to call them. And you don't have the natural milestone of the first boot or the merge boot or the winner. It's even though I think you could argue that this category is as important as any of those, I guess final juror, like, by definition, does encompass it most of the time. But that feels inadequate in a way. It's almost, yeah, it's technically true, but we need an actual name for these people to highlight just how important that is. But
I don't think I've ever heard anyone be referred to as the final juror.
I'm sure you have used that phrase multiple times over the years on here. It's
maybe.
And there is a kind of monkeys on typewriters aspect to that, where we've been doing this for close to 10 years now. Almost anything you could say about Survivor, you probably have said in some capacity. So I'm not trying to, that's not like a gotcha point that I'm trying to trap you with there. But basically, any switch to the way that the finalists are decided is going to have a big impact on who gets kicked out at our final hurdle. So when we go from the final two to a final three, that has a big effect. Or when we go from the final four, like the final immunity challenge, and then that being a normal round under the previous system, we now have the final four fire making, which this is not the main casualty of that, or really even an important casualty, but it does remove a lot of what is interesting about unpacking the role of that final juror, final four, bubble boy, bubble girl in the season, where before there always had to be some kind of internal logic to why that person was kicked out at the time that they were, and we'll get onto some of the different routes that people took to get there. Now it can just be, oh, well, they lost the fire challenge, so they were out. Like, and there's nothing really more to that.
Yeah, and not only like an internal logic within the game, I feel like at least with, and maybe this is based on a small sample size, once we switched over to fire making, the storytelling logic has at least potentially deviated a bit as far as how the bubble person is presented there, where it felt to me, and I feel like this was pretty deliberate for the most part over the bulk of the early years, like whoever ended up being the last one out before the finals would often get at least a coherent arc, and fairly regularly, if not very frequently, be presented as someone the audience should be knowing and liking and rooting for, with certainly exceptions in there. But now we're getting, it seems to me, and again, maybe as we get more and more cases of Final Four fire making, this will not prove to be a consistent trend, but like, I feel like Angela, for instance, who in a recent podcast, I forgot even was the bubble person on Ghost Island, probably would not have gotten the same degree of invisibility treatment, or whatever you want to call it. That's probably not the best way of putting it. Were it a non-fire making situation where if it were like an earlier season, just by virtue of being the person who came up just short in the finals, she probably would have gotten more of a story arc there. But at the same time, I don't know how often the Angela type, there are some along the way and we'll get into them, but I don't know how often the Angela type would have necessarily even been eliminated before the finals, or at least in specifically that spot, which it seems like historically is not reserved for, but for pretty understandable reasons, I would say, often going to be a person who had a pretty good chance at winning the game and the others left at the final immunity challenge, fairly frequently understood, if this person loses, none of us can afford to let them be in the finals next to us. So again, before we get into specifics there, let's talk about how we even got to this point, because I feel like it's generally thought of as the case, and certainly feel free to tell me if you disagree with this, but it seems like the initial transition from a final two facing the jury to a final three facing the jury was largely, if not entirely, a reaction to the frequency with which a big fan favorite who was in good shape to win had they made the finals was getting cut at final three, and the producer said, okay, well, now we'll have three people face the jury, but then that person just started getting cut at final four instead, obviously, and so now we have the fire making challenge. And I personally feel like the longer the fire making challenge remains a staple, the earlier we're going to see those sorts of players get cut, and the final five is now going to be the spot where the big obvious jury threat is eliminated, if possible, you know, without idols falling from the sky or immunity necklaces or whatever, if not sooner than that. So,
and that caveat is important, because when you know that there is an idol or an advantage behind every corner, inside every shrub, you cannot afford to let that person even get that far in the game if you can at all avoid it. So you're going to see those people, if there's any choice in the matter, get cut in like the early post-merge, middle post-merge, because that's when you have to do it if you're going to have any guarantee over how you can plan out the rest of the game.
Right, exactly. I feel like it is very understandable why both the audience and the producers would be annoyed by, to say the least, the regularity with which someone they were rooting for and someone who oftentimes on, like, by any objective metric, air quotes, deserved to be in the finals and win the game, whatever that means to whoever's making that judgment there. But as we have, I feel like, said repeatedly, and perhaps to the point of annoyingness over the years, probably more annoying for on my end than on your end, like, if you are the producers, the worst thing you can do is make it clear to the players that any random advantages can fall from the sky, or a new twist could come in at the very end game, and that's just part of how Survivor works now. Like, if you are the producers who are upset about this sort of player constantly coming up just short of the finals, the way you incentivize the other people in the game to keep them around longer is the exact opposite of what they are actually doing here. And I totally get the initial impulse, but it seems like to me like we have had a big enough sample size already, and it's probably just going to get more and more extreme as far as when that type of player is being cut sooner as we cast, it seems like, more and more game literate people and have a bigger pool of seasons that we've actually seen play out with fire making and advantages falling out of thin air, that maybe I'm completely insane here, but I do wonder if the producers will eventually come around and recognize the way we keep these big audience favorites in the game for longer is by removing that and by making it clear to the players up front, we are going down to a final two, especially now that the meat shield strategy has gone like semi-mainstream and they have far more game literate players these days than it seems like they did before.
I think that at this point, we have gone for so long without the final two being a staple of the Survivor format that it's really hard to make that comparison in a way that would convince people who need convincing, if that makes sense. Where if you are, if you're Tyler Perry, right, and you've seen the light, you've had this Damascene conversion, and you're the angel or the devil on Jeff Probst's shoulder trying to get him to overhaul the format once again, the fact that you have to go back such a long way to get consistent examples of how well the final two works versus the final three, I think it's generally agreed or argued that we are in a different era of the show now. And so if you had modern final twos versus modern final threes versus modern final threes with the new fire making setup, then it would be easier to make that argument in a way that was convincing. But at this point, when you're going back to, you know, the first half, or in some cases the first quarter of the show's run, I just don't know if that's going to get a fair hearing anymore.
I agree with that. And as a kind of side note, it is both depressing and also, I think, sadly realistic that maybe the only way this message ever gets through to Jeff Probst and company is if we have a Tyler Perry or Jimmy Fallon, like some sort of A-list celebrity pitching it. Like there's very little that could realistically happen within the game and on the show that they're actually there making and watching firsthand all the time. It is largely probably going to come down to what Tyler Perry says would be a good idea there. And now that I'm thinking
it would be very funny if that person ends up being someone who is a recent convert to Survivor, possibly one of these people who got into it under COVID, and they don't have the frame of reference for the final two used to be how the show ended. And of course, that's how the show ended. How could it possibly be any other way? And if they've just started watching seasons in the 30s or as we get into the 40s, and then they're like, yo, Jeff, I've got a cool idea. How about we have two people in the finals? And then, you know, it might need to be that kind of argument from first principles, almost, if we want to call it that, to actually get in his ear.
I think you may be right. And now that I think about it, I don't remember the exact specifics, but I feel like there was a few years ago something to the effect of Josh Wigler, like, explicitly trying to get in Jimmy Fallon's ear because he recognized exactly this, that, like, this is the only way to really change the way the show is done at this point is to have that sort of celebrity kind of influence there. But yeah, I think we are very much at the point where it has pretty firmly transitioned from, okay, this person is the big obvious jury threat. We can't let them make final three because then they're just one immunity challenge away from winning, to, well, now we can't let them make final four because they're just one immunity challenge away from winning. And now it's, we can't let them make final five because then they're one final immunity challenge away from being in fire. And at that point, there's nothing we can do.
It's like how you would hear tales of lobbyists or people who wanted something from a government or something, who they wouldn't go to the president or the president's chief of staff, because then it would seem like the kind of transactional plea that it clearly was. They would go to like the president's golfing buddies or something and try and get them on board, because they could fill that role as like the man on the street in Probstian parlance, who could present it as something that was authentic and, you know, coming from the outside and genuine. So I guess find that celebrity and work on them if you're trying to get any reform done in the Survivor universe. But let's get into the topic here of these people who ended up falling just at that final hurdle. And you can divide these up in a few different ways. You could look at them as those people who maybe prompted that initial shift from final two to final three, and they were the favorite to win. They maybe were the fan favorite or the Jeff favorite, and they fell just short. And what if there was a way to make stop that from happening as often? And then you have the people who, in a season that is dominated by one player or one alliance, you often see this where it becomes clear from very early on to them and maybe to the viewers as well that this is going to be the final two or final three, unless there's some incredible upset. And just mathematically, someone else has to be there at the final four, not someone that we care that much about, and that person's going to get clipped. So this might be like the Denise Martins of the world, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And then you also have, and this overlaps a bit with that previous category, you have these kind of mega goats where you would think this person, it would be in anyone else's best interest for that person to be in the final two, in the final three, with no real shot of winning the money. And the fact that they are the bubble boy or bubble girl means that there's a chance that someone just made a very, very costly mistake, or they had such a mortal lock on the outcome from however far out that it didn't matter what they did at the end. They can afford to take their friend, take someone who they want to get that second place money bump more, and they know they're going to win easily regardless. And I think Denise arguably falls in that category too, more so in the mistake side, where I think if Amanda had actually followed through on taking out Todd, we might be, that I think is a big butterfly effect for the rest of Survivor history there. And then there are people who kind of fall in the gaps in between, where it's kind of unclear how they actually would have done, and maybe it's contingent on how they get to the end, like who wins and takes them, or are they winning and are they taking someone else? And in that case, does that decision by itself affect the impact? So this is what we saw in the very first decision like this, right, where Hatch steps down from that final challenge, which I don't think he was really probably going to win regardless, but with the understanding that what needs to happen for me to win is for Rudy to go out, but not at my hand, because that loses me Rudy's vote. And if it does end up being 4-3 in that final vote, then that's going to be all important. So that in some cases can be the most interesting of this kind of subcategory, where the people who maybe could have won, maybe would not have won, or but it's up in the air versus the more kind of cut and dry cases that you see elsewhere.
So yes, I have this list in front of me that I wrote down and ran by Dom before we came on air to please correct anything in here if I have some wrong names or if I'm missing anyone, which I'm still nervous about him pulling some sort of gambit on me along the way, and it turns out one of these people wasn't actually a bubble person. But for the time being, I have, I believe, the correct list of people split between tiers of this person was definitely going to lose regardless. In many cases, probably got lucky even to make it to the bubble in the first place. And I don't know that Final Immunity Challenge results would have really swung much in either direction. I have people who, as far as I'm concerned, were pretty much definitely going to win if they had been able to make the finals. Definitely is a strong word, but I'm using it regardless because that's what I do. And then I also have a category of people that I am not entirely sure which way it necessarily would have gone. I don't know that there are firm answers to be had out there, but I would love to hear what you have to say, Dom, about this group of people, and potentially whatever the audience disagrees with, please let us know in the comments there. But I think to quickly return to something you just said, And I don't want to start with this tier. I think it would be more pertinent to just get the people who were almost surely going to lose and probably not get many votes, even if they had made the finals, out of the way first, and save the people who were in very good shape had they made the finals for later. But to quickly return to specifically the case of Rudy Bosch, I have Rudy squarely in the tier of he would have smoked either of Hatch or Kelly had he made it to the finals against either one of them. But just for your information, Dom, and for the audience's information, that may be one where we disagree. But let's begin with the people who were definitely losing no matter what happened and just so happened to be the person who was the final juror, I guess. So you flagged up the idea of these mega goats were like, it's almost inexplicable that they were the final person eliminated just before the jury, before the finalists faced the jury. And I don't think it is a coincidence that, at least as far as I would be concerned, and I think it is a pretty popular opinion, that the biggest mistakes in the history of Survivor in terms of people just lighting money on fire really stand out as Colby in season two and Wu in Cagayan. And on this list, I have both Keith Famey and Cass as people who were definitely losing no matter what happened.
Would you also want to make that argument for Amanda voting out Denise?
I think it is an argument one could certainly make, although I don't think it is quite as clear as the decision that Colby and Wu each faced. And to be fair, I don't think either of Colby or Wu was thinking it through from the standpoint of all I care about is winning. And if I just take this person to the finals, I have locked myself in as the winner and I'm going to be rich now. I think they had different priorities for separate reasons. And that's both understandable and fine with me, but I also think
I think that is a crucial difference here, because I agree in both of those cases there was some level of acceptance of what they were doing, or maybe greediness in wanting to have their cake and eat it too, where they get to be loyal and get that amazing storyline of going to the end with their close friend, their close ally, and also getting the $1 million in the end, even if that last bit didn't work out so well.
I think Colby in particular could have potentially in his mind in the moment fallen into that other camp of kind of like JT and Token Sheens is a classic example for me of, I've won the final immunity challenge. It does not matter who I take. So I'm going to performatively take the person that I want, that it's going to look and feel better to take.
And Colby is maybe the most interesting case out of all of these, because there is a segment of the fan base who says that Colby kind of knew exactly what he was doing, and it wasn't really a case of a kind of Coachian adherence to loyalty and integrity and so on. It was more of like, given how many eyeballs are on the screen at this moment, the optics, just like the raw optics itself, but also the how this will affect my public image, and especially as that converts into, you know, television opportunities and so on, it's almost better in a way if I stay true to my word, be the noble cowboy who takes Tina and loses but is still happy for her and pumping the fist for her at the finale when the vote is revealed, versus taking Keith, you know, maybe getting the first 7-0 vote of all time, you know, getting that milestone off the board real quick here and then moving on with your life. And I frankly don't buy that one iota. I think you can do the victory lap, be this incredibly beloved and successful Survivor winner, and then it is much easier, if anything, to parlay that into being a beloved and successful TV host, actor, whatever it is. And, you know, I think Colby's bank account, I imagine he's doing okay for himself, but even beyond the immediate, do I want $100,000 or $1 million right here, right now, playing the long game, I think it's still much better to take Keith, win the season, and then do what you can from there.
So quickly, yes, I have certainly heard that case made many times over the years, and I struggle to come up with many Survivor takes that I disagree with more than anything other than winning being by a mile the best thing for Colby's long-term image and career.
But the contrast I'm drawing with those examples, and then specifically Denise, although maybe we could find a few others, is there's often this, especially in the older seasons, this argument of, well, we don't necessarily respect this person in the game. Maybe we like them well enough, but we don't respect them. They didn't really do anything in the game itself, but they need the money the most, and people are going to respect that and vote for them on that basis. And I think Denise, certainly she was making that argument explicitly herself. I need the money, and you are taking money out of my kids' mouths or whatever by not taking it.
They're not
going to
get to eat the delicious money.
Right, they won't get the delicious lunch that she's serving up every day. But often that can bamboozle other people into having that same fear as well, is, well, what if they just feel bad for this person and they give them the money? And you get why that's an understandable fear to have, because what are you meant to say against that? Are you going to try and come up with a reason why you, single 20 something with no dependents, need the money more, right? Like, no, there's no, if the vote becomes about who needs it the most, there's actually nothing you can do to overturn it. Whereas if it's about your achievements or perception within the game, in theory you can make the best argument you can make and maybe sway some votes. Turns out Amanda did not make the best argument she could make, and then, you know, is up to $2 million poorer as a result of that. But I think that is That fear is often kind of looming over the end game of a Survivor season, and it's rare that we actually get to see that put to the test, in part because sometimes people buy into that fear and they vote out that person so that we never get that that example for the sake of science. But Denise is an example of maybe where that was in play, where, you know, you can see why Amanda tricked herself into thinking, well, the jury's going to hate Todd, he's kind of abrasive and he's being a bit of an asshole to people, and you know, John Robert and James might feel betrayed by him, whereas Denise, she hasn't betrayed anyone, right? And she's been the outsider, no blood on her hands. She's the kind of older, responsible adult compared to all of these young city kids in the finals. You see why you arrive at that conclusion, even though in retrospect you're like, Amanda, what the hell are you doing?
Right. Exactly. And that's why I would not put Amanda on the same tier, or in the same tier as Colby and Wu there, although I, of course, obviously knowing what we know now, a pretty egregious oversight there, along with Keith, Denise, Cass in this tier, as far as people who bubbled the finals, that I feel like that was pretty much their best case scenario, next to losing very nearly unanimously in the finals. I would say Sundra in Cook Islands certainly played a vital role in how that season played out, but I don't know that there were many conceivable winning timelines for her there.
I agree on Sundra, but she's an example who is impossible to fit into any other category, where like, you have that sudden switch from the final two to the final three being inaugurated in her season, so you can't even say, okay, well, how does she fit into the trend of who gets voted out last in a final three? Because they literally didn't know that was happening until they had to vote out one of Becky or Sundra. And then they didn't even really get to vote out one of Becky or Sundra, because we have this final four tie, which leads to a perfectly organic fire-making challenge in which no fire was actually made when it came down to it. But there are some of these cases where you just have to fix this massive asterisk next to them, because you know, grouping them with anybody else for any reason is just going to be misleading in the end.
And along potentially similar lines, in this category, the aforementioned Angela from Ghost Island was another fire challenge loser, albeit in this kind of manufactured fire challenge way. But I do think that is a distinction worth noting. And then Aaron Lobdell in Token Sheens, as I touched on already, I think JT was pretty aware that it did not matter who he ended up taking. And if he had any concerns about losing to Steven, which I don't think he did, I don't know that he is necessarily the type to say, well, thanks for the first 38 days, Steven, but I'm going to go ahead and lock up the $1 million if I'm even slightly nervous about you beating me. The same way I think Steven would definitely have done that to JT, like by his own admission, would have no problem done that to JT. But Aaron is another person who bubbled the finals that I don't know had many winning timelines just based on the general vibe it seemed like she had going on with the rest of the Timbira tribe pretty much the entire game. Christina Cha in One World, I think, probably got arguably pretty lucky to even make it that far and was probably not in there with much of a winning chance. Eddie Fox is someone I am lumping into this category, but do you feel like if Eddie had won the final immunity, he would get Malcolm, I would guess. He would get Reynold, I would guess. Maybe Andrea, potentially? Is Eddie someone?
I would say definitely Brenda as well, possibly therefore Eric on top of that. So, yeah, I think that was a challenge for $1 million.
Wow, okay. And so I may have Eddie in the wrong tier here. Eddie confirmed Rob God.
So with the final four, there's this additional element of if it's a final two, where I guess a final three, you have this final challenge and then someone has to make that all important choice, you can locate it squarely in their hands. And there's this kind of A or B scenario of, okay, well, if this person wins, this happens. Or if this person wins, then this other thing happens. Or if this person wins, they take person A or person B, and then maybe they win if they do this, they lose if they do this. With the final four, sometimes you get into these spots where someone could win the final challenge and then still have the outcome be out of their hands at the end. And just scanning over the list, I don't know if there are actually many examples of when this did happen, where someone won that final challenge and maybe someone influential won that final challenge but didn't get the outcome that they wanted there. I guess the one that springs to mind is Gabon, where like Sugar is just doing her thing and becoming the main character of the season, and so her kind of whatever it is that leads to letting Matty make fire or whatever, or voting out Matty, like that ends up happening instead. But otherwise, I struggle to find cases where it's like, okay, I could win the game if only I could vote this person out, but the others won't let me vote them out, and so I get torpedoed regardless.
Yeah, I think Sugar is probably the one exception to that. And I think Matty is an interesting case when we get to him along the way, but the one other person that I had in this tier of almost surely losing, even if they had made it there, but I'm not only not positive that is necessarily the case, I'm also now second guessing myself that this person was even a bubble person. But please confirm for me, Dom, that Tai Trang in Game Changers did indeed bubble and probably was not going to win.
Tai was definitely a bubble person, but not definitely an automatic loser, I think, depending on how that went, where I guess if who is bubbling instead in this case? Is it Sarah or is it Brad? Is it someone else?
Well, let's see. It's almost surely not going to be Troy Zan bubbling. I would guess it's probably Sarah Lucina bubbling in that case, that Brad probably gets Troy and Ty on his side.
In that case, maybe Ty wins that season. And I don't know for sure, but I think that certainly is not out of play. I would not lump him in this tier by any means. But just to circle back to Christina before we move on from this group, she is the perfect example of what I mentioned before, of when everyone watching that season basically knew that it was Kim's to lose, and almost certainly Chelsea was going to be at the end with her, and based on, you know, clues we got from the outset, pretty sure you can pencil in Sabrina as our third. And so when we get down to the finale, it's, okay, what order are Alicia and Christina going to go out in? That is the one remaining source of suspense there. And sometimes in those final four scenarios in particular, the person who goes on to win in this crushing landslide wins that final challenge, and so there is really no decision to be made. But that also maybe has burnished other people's historical legacies by saving them from the consequences of their likely decisions, right? So in the final four there, let's say Chelsea wins that final challenge. Well, now Chelsea and Sabrina have a lot of power in their hands, where do they stick true to their girl, to the person who has been with them the whole way. They can complete that amazing final three story. But if you let Kim into the finals, she will take you to the cleaners. Or do you take someone who is almost surely getting zero votes, even without Kim in the finals? And that is a million-dollar choice, where if you get it wrong, you now join the ranks of Wu and Colby and in that Hall of Shame, where I think there are a lot of potential Hall of Shame members who almost might be relieved that their friend did win that challenge after all and kind of took matters out of their hands.
I think I would have a lot more confidence in Sabrina to say maybe we should take Kim out now that we are this close to the end here. I could be dead wrong about this, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if we had seen that alternate timeline play out where someone else wins final immunity. I'm taking you at your word that Kim did indeed win the final immunity there. And Chelsea says, Kim is my girl. I will literally force a tie. And I want to be in the finals with Kim, even knowing that I'm probably going to lose. So moving on from the almost surely losing tier to the tier that I have questions about, where I think it's dependent on the circumstances in which they find themselves in their finals and in the finals. And all of this is beginning from the starting point of at the final immunity challenge. Like, nothing is changing up through this final round. And some of these are going to be quick, and some of them there may be a bit more to dive in on in chronological order, roughly. The first one that stands out to me is Lex in Africa. I feel like almost surely beats Kim Johnson, but also almost surely loses to Ethan. And I don't necessarily know that Lex would have voted Ethan out. Where do you land on this?
I'm kicking myself here because I know that Lex got into this topic on his recent Talking with T-Bird episode, but I can't remember exactly what he said. But from the outside, without that information directly from Lex himself, it does seem up in the air, firstly, who he would take, and secondly, who he would beat, right? Because I think it's pretty clear he beats Kim Johnson, but does he beat Ethan, and is it close, or is it a blowout, and if so, in what direction, right? I think that's, you can't really be too confident about any of that, even though I'm pretty sure Lex has answered that now conclusively. But I think there are many cases like this where you can't really lump someone into a definitely losing category, even though if they make one of these two choices, they are definitely losing, because it is actually a meaningful choice. It is a million-dollar choice who that person takes with them. So, yeah, you're going to find people, some of these bubblers who I think had the $1 million in their grasp. There was certainly a timeline where they could have got that, but maybe that was never going to materialize because they were never winning that final challenge and no one was taking them. So arguably Ceree in at least two of her seasons falls into this category. But then there are people who, you know, legitimately were just one challenge outcome away from a win, and they and their season are remembered completely differently. And maybe that has ripple effects for other Survivor seasons, but we kind of ignore that just because it didn't happen, and so why revisit the past like that?
Right, and well, we will momentarily be revisiting plenty of those situations when we get into the people who were not literally definitely going to win if the final immunity challenge had broken differently, but it certainly seems like they were in there with a very real chance, and I would say there are plenty who were definitely going to win if the final immunity challenge had gone differently. But as far as I don't know even which decision they would have made or how the jury would have voted. This may be a case where it's not necessarily all that worth even spending too much time on, because the prospect of this person winning certainly the final immunity challenge that they ended up being presented with, if not a random final immunity challenge, is exceedingly unlikely in my view. But Jan in Thailand, I assume if she somehow were in the finals against Clay, would probably win, and is at least getting votes against Brian, if not beating Brian. But I don't know how realistic either of those timelines are too often.
Yeah, she's not winning, and she's not getting taken. So that only exists in this hypothetical
right,
world.
Right. A more interesting case potentially Ian and Palau, I think for sure smokes Katie if they are in the finals together. I remain totally up in the air about what happens if he's there with Tom and if he or Tom is truly that interested in being there with each other, which you would think with Katie as the alternative, neither of them certainly should be that interested in sitting next to the non-Katie party there. But it did seem like Tom, at least during that final immunity challenge, was saying, if you drop, I will take you. And I would guess Tom probably sticks to that, although I'm certainly not 100% there. And I also feel like Ian could be the type to want to sit next to Tom, depending on how much heat stroke he gets over the course of that final immunity challenge in some slightly different timelines there. So what do you think about Ian and how he fits into this equation?
So I think he does beat Tom. I think it's narrow, and if Ian kind of implodes at that final tribal, then maybe he could lose votes that were his for the taking. But it's never going to be Ian versus Tom, I think. The explicit purpose of their alliance from the outset was, we're going to get down to three, and we'll battle it out, you know, man to man, and whoever wins gets to take Katie. And not quite sure how Katie herself would have felt about that, but that was the point. It's, we know that Katie is a $1 million meal ticket for one of us. The only question is who it's going to be, and if we have this pact that we are going to be the ones to decide that between us in that arena of the final challenge, then we can all be okay with that final outcome.
I would again add the caveat that when they are up there for however long and Katie is already off the perch and Tom is saying, if you drop Ian, I will take you, I believe that Tom would have taken him. And if
I believe that Tom is saying that because he knows his leg is about to go, and if the challenge reaches a natural conclusion, that natural conclusion is Ian winning and taking Katie. So I think he is maneuvering to try and lock Ian into that. And again, we have the Talking with T-Bird archives with both Tom and Ian now to check the tape there, where I believe what that tape would say is Tom would have taken Katie regardless. It was just, okay, you know, kind of desperation plea at the very end there.
Okay. I mean, I feel, at least the way it was presented on TV, and I'm probably not in a position to say this as someone who hasn't watched Palau in many, many years at this point, but I feel like Tom was throwing that offer out there pretty quickly after Katie dropped and about 10 hours before the challenge actually ended. So I don't buy that Tom was only saying that because he didn't think he could go that much longer in the challenge. But either way, moot point, obviously, as things...
I don't think it's a case of, oh, I'm feeling these spasms in my leg. My leg is about to go. I need to log this in now. It's more a case of, I can see the future here where in 6 hours, we're still going to be here and Ian will be showing no signs of feeling under the pressure whatsoever. And my joints will be starting to creak and so on. And at that point, if I make the deal or I make the offer, then it's going to seem like exactly what it is. It's, okay, I'm about to lose, but maybe I can swindle you into taking me, versus if I do it now, maybe it seems more authentic. But for that reason, I would actually lump Ian in with like the Rob Cesaninos of the world, where you can find matchups where maybe it's close. So for example, I don't know that Rob actually beats Jenna if the two of them are in the finals together, but it's a moot point. It's never happening because Matt is their Katie, where going into that finals, I guess that one is different because Rob is maybe not so high on his own chances of winning that challenge. He just is hoping and praying that Matt's going to win and take him and hand the $1 million to him. But yeah, I think there are kind of a few cases like that where you could put them on either definitely winning or unclear, depends on opponents. But you know, it's not a clear choice either way.
Yeah, I think by day 38, I guess it would have been, and probably not many days prior to that, but I think it's probably the case that if Matt had won that challenge, he was woke to the idea that Rob is going to trounce him, whereas he could at least conceivably get some votes against Jenna, although obviously we did not see that one come in. More on Rob Cesternino a little bit later here, but Rafe is the next person where, surely, if he wins the final immunity challenge, he just takes Stephanie and trounces her there. But do you think there were any timelines where, if he hadn't taken back his... hadn't taken back, like, Danny's obligation to him or whatever, were there any situations where Rafe is facing off against Danny in the finals, and how does that go?
No, Danny has confirmed that she was always taking Stephanie. She knew exactly what the deal was. I think Danny has her choice of who she wants to beat. I think Rafe would, you know, get more votes and put in a better performance and not be completely overtly drawing dead from the outset. But I think Danny still comfortably wins there, even just on the back of the votes that she knows she has on that jury. So, sure. You know, Bobby John and Gary and so on.
Okay.
So, yeah, Rafe is another case of, like, yeah, there's a hypothetical matchup where it could be close, but they are playing for the right to take Stephanie and to beat Stephanie. And with that in mind, you know, the releasing of his plea to Danny is an unforced error insofar as it looks terrible, right? And it's so easy to build that narrative around, oh, well, Danny was going to take Rafe, but hey, Rafe says you don't have her anymore, so good for you, Danny, take Stephanie and win $1 million. But that's more of a kind of a bad optics thing than it is a, oh, Rafe just gave away $1 million for no reason. You could argue the point at which Rafe gave away $1 million for no reason was letting Danny get to that final three challenge in the first place, but that's something we go over in pretty excruciating detail in our Guatemala rewatch series, where, you know, there are reasons which you don't see on the show for why that choice makes some amount of sense, where, like, Lydia also wins in a landslide if she gets to the finals, and Danny had been physically very weak for the days leading up to that challenge, and also maybe Rafe getting in his own head over, like, I know that the final challenge tends to be endurance, and that gives, you know, an older woman like Lydia with a smaller frame a much better chance of winning that challenge than she would have winning, you know, literally any other challenge. So combination of factors going into that. But yeah, Rafe isn't on the case of, like, he set himself up with his 70% shot and it didn't come through, and so he ends up as the bubble boy instead.
Yeah, and then shows up on day 38 to see the final immunity challenge be essentially who has the longest legs. The yes. Morning after, you just voted out 4'10" Lydia. So, moving on, we have an interesting case, I think, as far as a lot of people are concerned, although I remain skeptical. In the case of friend of the podcast, Yao Man Chan, if he had won that final immunity challenge, I for sure believe that he beats Dreams and Cassandra in the finals if that is the matchup that we end up with. But I am not, first of all, entirely convinced that Earl even gets voted out there, although it's certainly a possibility. Dreams and Cassandra were very tight and did not have the option to vote Yao out in the scenarios where he has that Final Four immunity necklace. But in the Earl versus Yao matchup, where somehow they are both there, I further remain unconvinced that Yao beats Earl, the way that I feel like I hear it talked about a lot of, like, oh, if Yao had just won that or had Dreams give him the necklace, he definitely would have won.
So friend of the podcast, Yao Man Chan, by the way, who, if asked, would 100% not remember that the podcast even exists.
No chance. I am fully, yeah, none fully whatsoever.
But technically, you know, if you've been on the podcast, you are a friend of it, we would hope. So that's a title that you get for life. But this is one of the cases that is most up in the air because, first of all, it's entirely inorganic, where this was the second season with a final three instead of a final two. And just like in Cook Islands, this gets sprung on them at the final hurdle. And so everyone in the game is kind of planning for this final two, only to have that swept out from underneath them, and suddenly it's a final three instead. And that really does affect what goes on in this endgame, I think, where Earl, you know, going into this, Earl knows, okay, I have Dreams and Cassandra, and they are loyal to me, and I can beat them. However, let's say I go to a final three with them. At that point, I cannot be confident in my own chances of winning a challenge, right? And I think Earl, does he maybe wins one reward challenge. I want to say like the final five reward or something, but feels like he is not even close to winning the majority of the immunity challenges. And that list of who has won a season without winning an immunity is like Sandra twice, Earl, and then like one or two other people.
Did Tommy Sheehan do it?
It's a pretty short list. I have to think he won at least one at some point.
I'm looking it up, but continue. Sorry.
Okay.
Earl and Yao.
So for Earl, he knows if I go down to a final three with Dreams and Cassandra, like the easiest people to beat, well, in all likelihood, Dreams wins that challenge and he takes Cassandra and I become the bubble boy instead. So there is a lot of value to him for having Yaman there, who will be loyal to him and will take him, is surprisingly good in the challenges for this kind of spindly guy in his mid-50s, and also can, you know, beat Dreams in that final challenge to actually give Dreams some competition and open up this timeline where Earl can win. So, and also with that, if that third person wins, whether it is Dreams or Cassandra, they are taking Earl. So in theory, if Earl can engineer this endgame where it's himself, Yao, and someone else, then he always gets to the finals and possibly always wins. But that's a big, literally, million-dollar question here, right? Is does Earl beat Yaman if that's how he gets there? And my answer is yes. And they kind of pull this at the reunion, and it seems like Yao wins if he makes it there. But bear in mind, this is firstly the reunion vote, which you can never put too much stock in. Years after the fact, after they've seen the season airing and they've had a chance to patch up some of those grievances from the season itself, and also when they are aware, more so than they are on the island perhaps, that the whole audience is watching, and of course you're gonna cast this hypothetical vote for this this guy who got screwed over, this fan favorite who everyone loves. Yeah, you're gonna chuck in a vote for Yaman, because why not? Versus when you're out there in the island and maybe you don't have the same organic wellspring of love and respect for Yaman, then that decision might be different. But also that decision is being taken against the backdrop of Yaman made this offer to Dreams. Dreams just screwed him over. And so maybe that sets up some sympathy for Yaman. Whereas any scenario where Yaman makes it further involves either Dreams following through on the deal, in which case maybe you respect the hustle that Yaman showed there, but maybe you look down on him for kind of screwing Dreams out of this vehicle and getting himself or not out of the vehicle, but out of the game, right? Getting himself voted out. And you don't have all of these other conditional factors in play. So it just becomes, who do you like more? Who do you respect more out of Earl and Yaman? And I think for the vast majority of the people on that jury, the answer always was and always has been Earl. So I think Earl wins there. And so the question becomes, like, could Yaman have won? And maybe Yaman becomes the woo, right? The, like, if all Yaman needs to do is win that challenge and vote out Earl, but instead he, you know, I think we could be talking about him in those terms instead.
I think it's very possible. And I think that Yaman may be, even by his own admission, an all-time case. Not that he wouldn't have gotten this treatment in plenty of other timelines. I think any situation where Yao Man goes very deep and is a powerful player and does as much cool creative stuff as he does along the way, he's going to look really good. But he, in our interview that we did with him, was very eager to acknowledge, like, oh, the edit completely removed all of the weird and annoying stuff I was doing all the time and just made me look great constantly. I think there are plenty of timelines for Yao Man, for another person who we're going to get to shortly, Kathy Vavrick O'Brien, who got glowing treatment. Not necessarily, I'm not trying to say they didn't deserve it, but I think the fact that they ended up going far and ended up having such incredible, long-lasting underdog stories could almost be like the polar opposite of, like, if they had been in a less fortunate situation early on and were just like an early boot, I could see them getting absolutely torched by the edit in alternate timelines to explain why they got eliminated early.
I wish I could say that the edit is removing all of the weird and annoying stuff that I'm doing, but it feels like, if anything, you make an effort to really double down on that. And just,
before I forget to do this, I have pulled up the Wikipedia, and after several attempts at trying to figure out where they list all of the different immunity winners, I can confirm Tommy Sheehan never won an immunity challenge and also never played an idol.
Huh. Well, he is unique in the broader scope of Survivor history then. But so I think Yao, finding that route for Yao to win involved changing a lot of things, which I don't know can be changed, as well as that sudden bait and switch with the final three. So that one is really hard to actually untangle there.
Yeah. So moving on from there, I feel like I have heard that Ashley Underwood in Redemption Island, Maine's own Ashley Underwood, would have at least certainly been in there with a chance to get votes, much more so than Natalie and Philip were. Have you heard anything about how she would have done hypothetically against Boston Rob in the finals?
So it sounds like the consensus these days is Rob had to be up against exactly Natalie and Philip, and anyone else, it almost didn't matter who it was, in terms of, like, let's say somehow Mike Chisel makes his way back from Redemption and wins the final challenges, wins in absolute ginormous blowout landslide. Ashley Underwood, who no one really had much time for in the game, seen as this appendage for Ometepe, always hanging around Natalie, also gets to the end, wins in a ginormous blowout landslide. I think I'm less convinced of that than I am of some of these other cases, because I think in a way it's easier to say that after the fact, where you don't want to admit that, yeah, Rob just had this stranglehold over the season, where in the game, it seemed like, based on the edit that we saw, Ashley wasn't really respected by anyone, spent most of her time just with other Ometepes, with Natalie, wasn't building those bridges with the Zapatero members, who were going to make up the majority of this jury here. So I think, like, Andrea, for example, would conclusively beat Rob. Ashley, I don't know. I think that one genuinely is more up in the air. It is funny, though, to examine this scenario where Ashley does win. And even if this involves taking Rob to the end and still beating Rob, where you would think, like, if Rob doesn't win that challenge, just vote him out, right? Go with Natalie and Philip and, you know, steal the easiest win of all time. But even if she goes with Rob, I think...
To add on, I agree with that, that if they do get it together and vote Rob out, Ashley runs away with it.
It would be very funny if Ashley beats Rob, and now instead of showing her being this kind of annoying, gross hanger-on, they are forced to make her into the deserving winner of the season, and so she gets this glowing portrayal instead, and it's this complete 180.
Yes. So how about Blood versus Water? Our bubble person, Tina Wesson, a former Final Tribal Council victor. I would imagine that if she wins that necklace and Monica and Jervis are acting like fully just in their own objective kind of self-interest there, and Tyson is voted out, Tina probably does pretty well there, although I can't say with 100% certainty that she would definitely win, but I could also very easily see it being the case that even if Tina had won that final necklace, Tyson is able to get Jervis to keep him and potentially even, like, force a tie. I'm not certain about in any situation, but is it necessarily the case that if Tina just wins that necklace, she's the winner of that season?
I think this might be one of those rare cases where you can win that final challenge but not have much control over who goes there with mm-hmm. you. And yeah, if Tyson and Jervis, the Coconut Bandits, stick together, then you could have this Tina, Tyson, Jervis, there we go, final three, where I think Tina probably gets it, where, like, let's say, okay, Vidas votes for Tina, I imagine. Katie Collins, of course, votes. Yeah. Aras maybe is a different question. I don't know if he would feel so betrayed by Tyson that he would vote for Tina, who, you know, Moret, I think, would vote for Tina. I don't know if Sierra would fall in the same boat as well, or if she would respect the game that, that Tyson played. That one really is up in the air, I imagine. But if it is Tina and then Jervis and Monica, I don't think that, we discussed this timeline of, let's say Yule gets booted at the final three in, or final four in Cook Islands, assuming it is a final three, like under the old system. Do all of those Yule votes just transfer to Becky, and now Becky is the winner of that season? I don't actually think that most of the Tyson votes would transfer to Jervis, even though the thing that really prevented Jervis from ever, not just winning, but ever being in contention to get a single vote, was that he and Tyson were just thick as thieves, and Jervis was seen as this kind of strictly inferior version of Tyson from the jurors' perspective.
Yeah, Tina... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think those votes actually would go to Tina. I don't know if you would see that first question come up of, do we really want to vote for someone who was voted out and had to come back into the game? Like, would that weigh on Hayden, for example? Like, do we see Hayden voting for Jervis, even though the two of them clashed a lot over the season? I don't know, honestly.
Yeah, Blood versus Water and that Final Four situation is one that I have a ton of questions about, and obviously we're never going to know, and I don't know how pertinent it is to even, like, dive into all of these counterfactuals or whatever, but I feel like I have just generally heard it talked about as, like, oh, Tina was one challenge away from winning again, and I don't necessarily know that that was the case, although very open to the possibility that it could have been. Similarly, I feel like Keith Nail in San Juan del Sur is often talked about as, like, another person who was one necklace away from certain victory, and I don't know that I would necessarily go that far. He's in this camp for me of, I could see him definitely getting plenty of votes, but I am not at all taking it for granted that if Keith had won that final challenge, he would have been the winner of that season.
I think it's another case of, is he facing Natalie? In which case, I think Natalie wins, or is he facing these mega ghosts in Miss Your Baylor and Jacqueline, where, okay, they each get the one vote from their literal family member or loved one, but they're not sure not getting anyone else. I think it's unclear insofar as it matters how he gets there, but once that is decided, the outcome is pretty clear. It's not really in doubt.
Yes, okay, so season 30, we have Rodney losing in fire as things played out, and I don't know that the fire challenge made a huge difference. I don't see him beating Mike Holloway, assuming Mike wins that final immunity challenge. But if Mike loses that challenge and we do get a final three of Rodney, Will, and Mama C, is Rodney the winner there?
It pains me to say, but I think so. I especially as we get into the 30s. I really have no sense of how these alternate timeline final threes or final twos actually play out.
Yeah, and just by virtue of being the penultimate pick in our draft that season, I feel like that gives him an edge for being the eventual winner. So
he gets the Dom and Colin bump, for
that's
sure.
That's right. So how about Dom?
We know Kelly Wentworth wins 10-0, and it's actually 11-0, even though there's only 10 people on the jury, because Jeff himself would be so overwhelmed by her amazing performance that he would have no choice but to walk over to that voting booth himself and cast the final vote for Kelly Wentworth.
And not only that, she gets $1 million for first place, and then Sia comes on bombarding the stage at the live reunion and gives her $1 million just for being the best.
And Spencer and Tasha actually insist that they be allowed to cast votes for Kelly Wentworth, even though they themselves are competing against her in the finals.
Yes, so congratulations to Kelly on the first 14-0-0 $2,200,000 prize in the history of Survivor in that timeline where she wins that necklace. How about David versus Goliath, Dom? I certainly was a believer in Kara Kay along the way, but I largely based on the compelling losing finalist I thought I was seeing, and just the big character that it didn't seem like they necessarily would have been so inclined to focus on if she were not a very deep run kind of player on that season. But do you feel like had Nick Wilson not run the table down the stretch there in the immunities, that was Kara's game to lose?
I don't know, actually, and this is an example of this other category where, let's circle back, as we always end up doing, Colin, to Christina Chah, where that's someone who was a fourth wheel in the majority alliance that ended up becoming the final three. So she was always going to be in there towards the end, and you would think always be there at the end, because who wouldn't want to go against Christina Chah? But she ends up getting cut because Kim can afford to go on this victory lap, so to speak. Whereas when we get to cases like Eddie Fox is a great example here, often what happens is you have this maybe slightly smaller majority alliance that goes deep, ends up turning on each other, and so some of the bigger threats from that get cut, and then there's this kind of a internal struggle within that, and then one of the outsiders who's left over just kind of bumbles their way towards the end, and eventually you're like, oh shit, we have one challenge left, and if this person wins, then all of their friends are on the jury, so sure hope we win this one and actually get to vote that person out. And I wonder if Kara is an example of that, or maybe, and I'm sure this would have broken both of our hearts and scrambled our brains permanently, if she makes it to the end, but still doesn't actually get any votes because people weren't buying what she was selling.
Yeah, I do think it is unlikely that she gets like blanked in the finals there, but I think I would probably be leaning towards a Mike White victory being the most likely outcome there. Mike White was robbed, or so I've been told. How about...
That's another thing, though, of does Mike White have that killer instinct at the finals? Because if he turns it on and doesn't effectively say, oh, hey, I have a lot of money, I don't care about winning so much, if he really is intent on playing a full 39 days and making a case for himself, is that enough to spring any more votes at that final hurdle there? And does that depend on who he's facing off against?
I honestly don't know, but I feel like Mike White doesn't get the credit that he's generally due, both as a Survivor player and furthermore, I always felt so bad. Not just a filmmaker, a screenwriter, where Mike White, a lot of fun was had at his expense, particularly as things pertain to the Emoji movie. And I know people have a soft spot in their heart, or at least a certain subset of Survivor fans does, for a couple of his Jack Black movies that he did. The Mike White HBO show starring Laura Dern and co-starring Mike White himself, Jason Mantzoukas, was also on this, along with many others, called Enlightened, was so damn good. And anyone with HBO Max, go and watch that immediately. It was all written, at least the first season, I believe it was all written by Mike White himself, and it is incredible. So do be checking that out, and do be putting some respect on Mike White's name.
How do you balance these things out? So how many seasons of that show make up for an Emoji movie? Like, what's the conversion rate there?
There are two seasons of Enlightened. I forgot to mention Luke Wilson, another Enlightened co-star on there. And then, God, who plays Laura Dern's mom? It's another legend is on that show. But I would say the either 20 or 26 episodes of Enlightened way more than make up for the Emoji movie. It was just tragically not a smash hit and then cut short, but it is still certainly out there on streaming platforms. So do yourself a favor and watch.
Would you say that his combined body of work in David versus Goliath is more of an Emoji movie or more of a season of Enlightened?
I would say it's more of a season of Enlightened. I feel like he was out there doing very well.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Yeah, all right. So enlighten yourself and go watch Enlightened. It's been I know I bring that up every time Mike White comes up, but that's like maybe once or twice a year at this point. So, all right, moving on, Dom. I am curious about the case of not only Benjamin Button, but also Lauren Ashley Beck from whatever the hell that season, Island of the Idols. I would imagine that if she finds herself in the finals against Dean and Nora, she runs away with it. But Lauren versus Tommy, I would probably lean towards Tommy still winning, but I think that is much, much closer than the actual finals that we saw.
I think I lean towards Lauren winning, but again, this is my constant quibble during that season, is I can't tell who's working with who likes each other, how much loyalty they feel to each other. It's all just a mess, and that becomes especially apparent when you get down to the jury phase, where I have no idea who's, I mean, once it's Tommy versus Nora versus Dean, okay, that one seems pretty locked up. But in terms of literally any other matchup, whether it's Tommy against Lauren, either of those people against Janet, let's say, or Elaine, I defy anyone to tell me who's running for who in each scenario there.
Well, I think that would require remembering things about Island of Extinction, which we have all wisely just wiped from our memory.
Do you mean Island of the Idols?
Yes, Island of Extinction. Exactly.
Are you also lumping in Edge of Extinction as a season in which we would all rather scrub from the record altogether?
Yeah, what happens if Tommy faces off against Victoria Baymondi in that season's final, Dom?
The Battle of the Redheads.
Yeah, that's right.
Sad to announce to everyone that Tommy actually still wins that season. So that would be a true heartbreaker for the Victoria stands out there. But I think Lauren would beat Tommy, but I can't tell how much of that is Lauren like tooting her own horn and saying that she would beat Tommy versus her kind of being wrong about that and maybe being a woo, setting herself up to take him and lose to him. Or her saying, yeah, I either would or would not have beaten Tommy, but it's an academic question because we were never going to the finals together. Yeah, we always were intending to cut each other, which I think is the case, but I don't know.
I don't know either, but would be curious to find out. And then similarly here, we have another duo that I would lean more towards the camp of they were willing to sit next to each other in the finals, if not like dead set on doing that and showing down and seeing who would emerge triumphant in that situation. How about our most recent season, Winners at War? Sarah Lucina ends up being our bubble person here, and I would be leaning at this hour that she was willing to sit next to Tony, and I don't know that that necessarily would have gone her way, but assuming that things play out the way that they did and Sarah just wins that fire challenge, I have very little doubt that she would have also run away with that final vote over Natalie and Michelle.
I agree. There was some discussion of how a lot of jury members seemed somewhat bitter towards Sarah and maybe they would go for Natalie instead, or maybe Michelle actually gets a vote in this scenario, as a lot of fans seem to think she was entitled to the whole time. But I think it's still a comfortable win for Sarah, if not a bit closer, and maybe the final tribal wouldn't have quite the same good-humored tone to it as Tony's did. But this is another tree with three branches, I think, of either Sarah goes to the end with Tony, and she was willing to sign up for that, and Tony wins, and then I'm sure Sarah would have a lot to say about the biases at work there after the fact, or that decision is taken out of her hands. And this is actually another thing that can happen with the fire challenge, is you might want to go to the end with the person that might beat you, whether you know that or not, whether you're happy about that or not, but you kind of get rescued from that choice by somebody else, right? Where, like, of course, if Natalie wins and takes Michelle, even if Sarah, in her heart of hearts, really wants to lose to Tony, she won't get to. She'll either win the season or get fourth place. So that almost is better for her legacy, right?
But I
think Sarah wins as long as she's not against Tony, but maybe this is exactly what needs to happen for that to even be possible. And you might argue that Malcolm and Denise in Philippines are in the same category too, where if it is the fire challenge and there's no question of will you commit to me, will you take me to the end, or were you going to take me if you had won the challenge, if let's say Scoopin wins that final challenge, then clearly he's taking Lisa, and clearly it's one of Malcolm or Denise playing for the right to beat them, then I don't know if either Denise's legacy is different, whether she wins or whether she loses that final four fire making there.
I mean, I think she's probably regarded in the pantheon of like survivor history a lot less memorably if she loses that fire challenge and is not eventually a survivor winner. But yeah, I certainly take your point there. And Dom, go ahead.
This is a final word on that. I obviously have a ton of respect for Rob Cesnino in general, and a lot of the stuff that he puts out there. And
I am very excited for this, but
okay. But the one time where I've just been like, unable to contain my frustration at a podcast that I can remember is when I think it was the very first time he ever interviewed Denise, and he just didn't ask about the workings of that Final Four round, where it's like, why did you want to take Malcolm to the end, knowing that he would have won? What was the point where he kind of the scales dropped and he wasn't able to pretend that he was going to take you to the end? Like, that is the one thing about that season that you really want to draw down on, and it just didn't happen. But
so, just for the record, that is Dom calling Rob Cesternino a complete fraud, not me.
No, that's not. Whatever. Why do you hate Rob so much, Dom? God.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Well, let's move over into the tier that Rob himself, I believe, falls into, along with, frankly, many other people here who ended up bubbling the finals. But I would contend that had they won the final immunity challenge or the fire challenge, whatever situation was pertinent to them, they either would have had their choice of who to take unilaterally or would have gotten their way on who they were sitting next to. And I have very little doubt in my mind that that would have ended up going in their favor as far as the final jury vote is concerned. So I'm going to roll through these and you tell me where you disagree. As we got to maybe an hour or so ago at this point, the first one that I have here from the very first season, I feel like if Rudy had kept his hand on the pole and not forgotten about the rule that when you're changing from station to station, you need to leave it on there, I believe he would have taken Rich for sure, and he would have smoked Rich for sure. Similarly, had Kathy Vavrick O'Brien not been distracted by her shirt falling off or whatever and managed to win that final immunity challenge, I assume she would have taken Nalia. I don't think it really even matters which decision she ends up making there. Maybe it does. Maybe I'm buying too much into the Kathy lovable underdog edit, and the row two people on the jury may not have necessarily felt the same way. So this one I'm a little less confident in, but certainly against Nalia, I feel like Kathy is in fantastic shape. If she wins that final immunity challenge, she is almost definitely the winner of that season. And now the guy Dom just called a confirmed fraud that I do not agree with at all along those lines. But Rob Cesternino, I do believe that certainly Jenna was not going to take him, obviously, and I think it is at least conceivable that had Matthew won that challenge, he was not going to take Rob either by that point. But if Rob himself had been able to hold the headdress up and win that challenge himself, there is no question that he is the winner of that season. There are a couple more that I'm less certain about, so I'm just going to go through the ones that I feel like dead certain about. If they win the final immunity challenge, they are the winner. Terry Dietz, I feel very strongly that if he wins that hopping along the, what are they called, the like lily pads challenge, he is the winner of that season. He just wrecks Danielle DiLorenzo in the finals. Matty Whitmore in Gabon, I would guess, has his way with any combination of people that he's there against in the finals. If Sugar doesn't decide that she would rather let Bob go to a fire challenge instead, even in the timelines where Maddie doesn't win final immunity. But if he has that necklace, I think it's game over. Jerry Manthe in Heroes versus Villains, I feel, probably performs very well against any combination of the other three there that she was with in the Final Four. I guess I have skipped over Brett, not Mike Tyson, but Brett in Samoa. I guess I'm not 100% sure that every single, like, I don't know that Shambo necessarily votes for Brett. I don't know that, like, John Fincher, confirmed poser, rocket scientist married to Parvati, total poser, necessarily votes for Brett, but I feel like you've got to feel pretty good about Brett's chances there, despite him not being...
With the way that season played out, if you told someone nothing about how the finals would go except Shambo will not vote for you, you would be pumping the fist, because that means almost surely every other single galoob is going to vote for you.
That's an excellent point. Ozzy in South Pacific, I think there would be a reasonable amount of people who would not be thrilled about the idea of voting for Ozzy and may not go through with it. Like, I don't know that Cochran is necessarily falling over himself to vote for Ozzy, but I would guess that Keith, Whitney, Jim, Dawn, and Brandon are probably pretty secure Aussie votes in the timelines where he wins that final challenge, so I would be penciling him in.
I would question Dawn's vote in that scenario, depending on who that third person was, because Dawn said in her talking with T-Bird, to come back to that again, that she was really not happy with how Ozzy treated especially the women on the tribe in Sabai in the early days. And so I think if, and like, she is not going to jump over herself to vote for Coach, but let's say it's Ozzy, Sophie, and Albert, for example, or I don't even know, like Ozzy, Coach, and Sophie. I think if Sophie is there, Sophie gets Dawn's vote.
Okay.
If it's Ozzy, Coach, and Albert, I think none of the above would be Dawn's preferred option there, but I don't know, honestly.
I feel like Ozzy would be at least the favorite to win there, although maybe not quite in this same territory that I am now putting him in, of like, they win the necklace, it's game over, they're the winner. One person I do feel good about putting in that camp is Malcolm in season 25. He very gladly, I think, sits next to probably Lisa and Scoopin, although I don't know that it even necessarily matters much if he is there. I think he probably wins that season. David Wright, I think almost for sure if he wins the necklace. Adam is lock gone, and David probably wins unanimously instead. And then Rick Devens, if he wins that fire challenge, I feel very confident in being the eventual winner there. So we have a
How about Devin Pinto, who is exactly one Devin? How does he fare?
Well, so this is the other kind of players pretty much in the same tier for me of, if they win the final immunity or the fire challenge, I would definitely have them as a big favorite, but I'm not going to put them in the like almost lock winner tier just because I think there is a potential kind of distinction there. And so the last several names here that I think kind of fall into this camp, let's start, I guess, with the one you just brought up there, Devin Pinto. Yeah, I do believe pretty strongly that he would win, although I am not willing to say that as conclusively as I am about like a Rudy or a Rob Sesternino or a Terry Dietz type.
Yeah, that that final outcome has always been heavily contested to this day among the fan base, where not only do you have Ben kind of being smuggled into the finals under possibly illicit means, and then
possibly
okay, but you see what I'm saying, and then the controversy over him actually beating Chrissy once he gets there, then you have the whole debate of whether Chrissy ever actually could have won, like, was she drawing dead even if Devin wins that final challenge, and are we overrating her as a player because of that, and then like, was Ryan ever actually in serious contention to win any votes? And so all of the possible outcomes there have some kind of a baggage to them, which makes it hard to really get a grip on it.
Right, but I would feel very good, I think, about Devin's chances there. And then along similar lines, this is honestly a person that may belong in the category of, if they win Final Immunity Challenge, it is just game over. I think in Pearl Islands, if Johnny Fairplay wins that Final Immunity Challenge, he takes Lil and runs away with it.
And most notably, he thought that Lil was going to win that challenge and take him, and he would run away with it. But instead, Lil discovers her conscience, I suppose, and doesn't want that money to disappear up Johnny Fairplay's nose, and decides to give it to the hardworking military wife instead.
Right. I think it was absolutely a situation where Lil was holding or wearing the necklace saying, I am not going to win. I am essentially a one-person jury right now. So moving on from that, I would lean pretty strongly, although I'm not 100% sure, but I think we could very conceivably have been one Jenna Lewis immunity necklace away from her winning the original Survivor All-Stars, probably against either of Rob or Amber.
Yes, and again, it's not like, oh, everyone really wants to vote for Jenna, but she fell too short. It's, my God, we have to vote for Jenna of all people, but hey, if that's better than voting for Romba, then that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think they just played such a complete scorched earth game that they were pretty close to dead against anyone that was not exactly the other person there. So moving on from that, I feel pretty good about Scout winning at least against Twyla, and probably probably doing better than Twyla did against Chris. I don't know if Scout versus Chris was a realistic matchup in any conceivable scenario there. So I would be comfortable saying that if Scout had won that final immunity challenge, and potentially if Twyla had won that immunity challenge instead, that Scout would have been in very good shape to win Vanuatu.
Definitely, if Twyla wins, she takes Scout. There's no question about that, I think. I believe Scout wins that, but how does Chris vote there? I assume Chris votes for Twyla.
I would be betting on Scout, but I would be rooting so hard for Twyla to be a Survivor winner.
Honestly, Scout would be a pretty hilarious Survivor winner as well.
Yeah, and then the saddest name that we're going to get to in this context, although as far as I'm concerned, the brightest name among the brightest names in the history of Survivor in the grand scheme of things, but it is heartbreaking every time we have to think about what happened to Ceri Fields in Micronesia, where they all think they're playing down to a final three. Parvati and Amanda are happy to go along to a final three where they're going to get trounced by Ceri, and then we have to play one more immunity challenge. And even though it is a challenge pretty much tailor-made for an emergency room nurse to sit and hold your hands still for a long amount of time, Ceri is unfortunately not able to get that one done. But I have to imagine that under pretty much any other circumstances, Ceri is the winner of that season.
That is less of a consensus than you might imagine, because there are people who will argue that either Amanda or Parvati actually wins in that scenario. And this ties into the wider debate over Parvati's legacy, I think. And this is kind of an offshoot of the Parvati versus Sandra debate, which after a decade is still going strong in some quarters, where if you think about her three-season stretch, where Cook Islands, she's there, I suppose, and you will find some real edgelords who argue Cook Islands was actually Parvati's best game, and I've been known to dabble in that case from time to time.
Wow.
So after Cook Islands, no one is highlighting Parvati as, this is a greatest of all time player or character. Then she comes back for Micronesia, she's at the head of the Black Widow Brigade, and she wins, but there's always this question of, I don't know if we had this final three still in place as all of them were expecting and playing towards, if that actually would have happened. And so if we get to the point where Parvati's first two seasons are she gets sixth place in Cook Islands and no one really cares, and then she woos herself into second place maybe in third place even in Micronesia, and at that point I assume she maybe still makes it to Heroes versus Villains, because you need some young female villain to make out the numbers there. But she's not coming in with that same reputation of, oh my god, she is super dangerous, we have to get rid of her at all costs, and that kind of uphill battle that she faced the whole way in that season. So maybe everything about Heroes versus Villains changes as well. But what that means is, if you are a Parvati partisan, if you want to make the case that she is the best of all time, a lot of that rests on, she crushes Micronesia, and then with the deck stacked against her, gets second and arguably should have won in Heroes versus Villains. A lot of that rests on believing that Parvati was not playing herself towards a lost endgame in Micronesia, right? So if you examine those votes, where it's a final three and it's now seven people voting instead of eight, Ozzy and James are always going for Amanda, right? And then Natalie Bolton, always going for Parvati. And then the others seem mostly up in the air. But, if you want to argue that, for example, Parvati had Alexis on lock, and then Parvati had, that's already four votes accounted for, and Ceri needs to win this kind of 3-2-2 against the vote splitting some other way. So if you think that both of them, Amanda and Parvati, start with more people naturally in their corner, then maybe Amanda is actually the person who is the favorite to win there and not Ceri, despite what you might think from the outside.
Well, other three people are Eliza, Eric, and Jason Siska, I feel good about them being Team Ceri.
Jason Siska is hard to pin down, I think. But as far as I can tell, each of Eric, Eliza and Alexis have all said after the fact that they wanted to vote for Ciri. They planned to vote for Ciri, and they were heartbroken when they saw that Ciri was actually coming to Ponderosa instead of remaining there in the finals. And so I think Ciri does have that three-vote cushion that she needs to build on. And maybe it is 3-2-2, and it's a remarkably close vote, you know, closer than we've ever really seen in a Final Three before. But I think it is still a win for Ciri there.
Yeah, and who better to win a final vote like that than the pioneer of the 3-2-1 split back in Exile Island? And yeah, even as a big-time Parv to San, I screwed that up, but people get the pun, myself, I do think it's a completely different story in Heroes versus Villains if she's not spending the entire time as this player that everyone is nervous about letting go far and constantly gunning for. I think she still makes the cast. I don't see Danielle DiLorenzo staying on the cast over Parvati, for instance, even if she ends up being a losing finalist in Micronesia instead of the winner there. But I do probably feel like her game would be less impressive if she did not have that enormous target on her back in Heroes versus Villains. And I don't know what the current state of Parvati in the like greatest players of all time ranking would look like, especially if she didn't have a win on her resume there. So yeah, that's a big time kind of sliding doors moment for sure. But let's not spend too much more time dwelling on the heartbreaking Ciri loss there. How about Survivor Nicaragua, Dom? Holly Hoffman is someone that I feel like is often cited as a robbed goddess from the history of Survivor, where if Fabio just loses that final immunity challenge, he is out, and then she is there up against Sash and Chase. Is it your testimony that she would be the winner?
I think so, yeah. So Nicaragua is weird because you have this early post-merge, right, where you know, Alina goes out, Marnie goes out, and then you have what in real time felt like this complete seismic shift in the season. You know, one of the best blind sides of all time, where Brenda's own alliance turns on her. They dethrone the queen. There's this uprising from within. And just as we're about to see the full consequences of that, we have the double quit. And so that progresses the game. It kind of accelerates it to this new position where at that point it feels kind of scripted, where it's like, okay, we know we need to get rid of Fabio and Benry because they can win the challenges. And Dan Lembo is also still a contestant on the season. And you fall into this quite natural 4-3 dynamic. And okay, you vote out, Fabio wins, you vote out Benry. You don't have a chance to vote out Fabio. So all of your choices at this point are moot. So even though we get the Jane, you know, blindside somewhere in there, which is this big moment down the final stretch, for the most part, it feels like the season is hurtling towards this inevitable outcome where none of the choices that anyone can make really matter anymore. And so, yeah, we get down to Final Four where I have to think, yeah, if Fabio loses, they vote him out, and then people did not want to vote for Chase, and Chase was not helping his own argument at any point. And so even though Holly had her fair share of enemies and controversy surrounding her, I think Holly still wins there.
I think I'm on the same page with that. And then one of the more interesting kind of alternate timelines to me over the years is the last name on this list, unless I have forgotten anyone here. How about Ko Rong, Sydney potentially being a finalist there? I really would love to know what happens, particularly in a Sydney versus Aubrey versus Michelle situation, because I think she probably would be a pretty compelling candidate.
The sense I get from Ko Rong was that the same forces that deliberately flipped it against Aubrey onto Michelle were going to do the exact same thing versus Sydney. If, yeah, she was never getting the votes of Scott or Jason, and they in turn would have done their best to get a majority for someone else, regardless of who it was.
Okay, I guess I've always thought of that as more of a specific to Aubrey kind of situation than it sounds like it necessarily was. So
I think the other thing going on there is both Michelle and Aubrey had a few people who were solidly in their camps from the outset. So of course Julia was voting for Michelle, right? And of course Joe and maybe Nick or Neil were going to vote for Aubrey. I don't know who you can pencil in as they really want to get to vote for Sydney.
Yeah, that's, you know what, a pretty fair counterpoint. I guess just in my own mind, I feel like Sydney belongs in that conversation with the two of them, if not, not like near the top of that conversation. I don't even know which way I would be leaning there, but I do think it is at least conceivable, although I now probably should not have ultimately put Sydney in this tier among these other people who were like one challenge away from near certain victory. But
Colin, you would vote for Ty because you respect women and don't want to sully the names of any of them by casting a vote for one over the others.
Yeah, as the ultimate feminist here, I'm going to vote for Ty in this equation. But I feel like Sydney would have been, at the very least, an interesting person to have in the finals there, and I am by no means willing to rule her out, even if everyone in their exit press said that was never conceivably happening. So, awesome way to round out this list of people who were one challenge potentially away from being in very good shape at Final Tribal Council. But Dom, anything else that you wanted to get to as far as people on the bubble are concerned?
So did we actually cycle through all of them here, or did we deliberately leave a few out?
I have not deliberately left anyone out, although if you have some surprises to spring on me of people I have forgotten along the way, now would be the time to do so. I would also say, actually...
Well, now that you... No, I don't, but okay. What were you going to say?
As one final note, I do think it is worth flagging up to return to the idea of the bubble person so often being robbed. Many of the names, particularly in this final tier that we just talked about, of people who were one challenge away from winning, and to use like the ultimate example of Terry Dietz to illustrate what I'm getting at here, are people who, yes, they were one challenge away from winning, but every single other person in the game also knew that they were one challenge away from winning and would never let them touch the finals otherwise. And I think that is a distinction worth making, where we talk about a lot of people as like totally robbed and it's such an injustice that they go out at the spot just before the finals, whatever that situation is, that again has evolved pretty substantially over the course of Survivor history at this point. And who knows how it's going to evolve in the future and what kind of bubblers we're going to be looking at a year or two from now even. But it is, I think, like one of the more, I'm not going to say overlooked because people are aware of this, but like under discussed points of just general Survivor strategy, that being that person, yes, as far as the audience and the producers and the TV product are going to be concerned, is going to look like such a robbery, but like in the grand scheme of actually playing Survivor, as Adam Klein, I remember, flagged up in a pregame interview he did, I think it was pregame, with Dalton Ross, when Dalton was asking people about what kind of changes they would like to see made to the format of the show now that Survivor's in the kind of throw whatever we can at the wall and see what sticks and we're going to mix this up constantly season after season kind of mode, talking about how he would want to get rid of the fire challenge, and he understands why they implemented it, because people like in his first season, Dave Wright, were so often being that finals bubble person. But if you are in a situation where everybody knows that they cannot possibly afford to let you make the finals, you are not playing the best game. And the meat shield strategy that I feel like we've seen evolve, particularly in recent years, although this is certainly something that Richard Hatch understood season one, 20 plus years ago, without any kind of blueprint being laid out for him, is a point that I know I'm annoying about and probably bring up too often, but like that is just a fundamental piece of playing good Survivor, is mitigating your threat level. And Adam gave a really good answer to Dalton along those lines, and it is something that I am hopeful we will see continue to evolve over time here, instead of going the route of just throwing in more and more ways for that person to bail themselves out. So that, though, I believe, Dom, is going to wrap it up for us here.
Well, I do think it can be unfair to say if everyone knows they have to get you out and you have to win it out, then you're not playing the best game, because sometimes if you find yourself in the minority position, then very often, you know, your actual fate was kind of determined for you 3 or 4 rounds ago when that pivotal merge vote happened or whatever, but you're still in there and you're still the favorite to win as long as you can get there. But you know, the other people in the game are not idiots. They know what the deal is. And sometimes that's unavoidable. You know, sometimes you let's take my boy Mike Chisel as an example, right? Where I think if his tribe goes into the merge with a lead, he maybe plays the most dominant game of all time. But as it stands, you know, when you flip one switch and instead he's there post-merge and they know they have to get him out as soon as humanly possible because, you know, it's obvious, right? It doesn't even need explaining. Then I don't think that's a mark against him. It's just people know exactly what the deal is. And I think there are some players who, for them to succeed in the first place, they have to adopt this playstyle, which means they can never fly under the radar, right? They can never be anything other than what they are. And so I think it's a good rubric in general, right? If you're trying to compare different Survivor winners to say, you know, how good is this player on balance? I think it is a good point to bring up that, well, they're only in that conversation in the first place because they had to win X immunities to get there. But I think in some cases, that's just always going to be the case, and there's not much getting around that. The one case I do want to come back to very quickly is Jerry in Heroes versus Villains, where that is a unique case where every person in that final four had a different vision of what the incentives were, who they wanted to sit next to, who would beat who, and so on. And Russell wins that final challenge, and I think he gets what he wants in the case of, or rather, he gets what he wishes. He doesn't get what he wants because he thinks, okay, all I need to do is vote out Jerry, and who would possibly vote for Sandra, right? It turns out he's wrong about that, but I think him having the necklace and then having the freedom to, you know, threaten Parvati that if he doesn't go along with him, then it's going to be her instead, that does actually have a material effect on how that final four vote ends up going down, where if Parvati if she sees more sense about the way things are going there, she might know that Sandra has to go, but she can't make that happen by herself. And if Russell is determined to take out Jerry and Sandra just wants any way to get to the final, so she'll gladly go along with Russell on that and feed his ego and tell him that, oh, of course you're going to beat me, then it's much harder for her to have as much room to play safely. That is a case, I think, where so many different things could happen, and even just changing which of the other people who seem like they were safe wins that necklace does have an effect on that vote and therefore the outcome of the season too.
Okay, I definitely see what you're getting at there, although I think in practice Russell is more or less right about that, like, if there's anyone that I can beat, it is Sandra, and I think had Jerry made it there, she would have beaten Russell and Parvati by more than Sandra did. I think let me roll through the votes quickly here. There is one vote that for sure flips from Coach, I believe, would vote for Jerry instead of for Parvati, and all of the heroes still vote for Jerry, I would imagine. So I think you are right about that being an interesting kind of point and a potentially unique one where it is rare that we see that many kind of alternate timelines that could have potentially come in, but I don't think the result is all that different, and I do think that any situation where Jerry makes the finals there is one where she wins.
Yeah, and maybe there's a further discussion to be had there, but I thought I would highlight that just because, you know, in many of these examples, either everyone does know what the stakes are, or everyone should know what the stakes are. And that stood out to me as a case where that wasn't actually true as much as it maybe should have been.
Okay, yeah. I certainly see what you're saying as far as, like, Parvati pitching that Jerry is going to be easier to beat than Sandra, I think is just wrong, and Russell is just delusional, and Sandra doesn't care. But, yeah, either way, a good point. And one final note is, it's been a little while since I think this person has come up on air, but one kind of low-key constant for literally as long as I have been talking about to Survivor, talking to you about Survivor, is your love of Mike Chisel and just the dominant game that he was playing and all of the accolades that would be laid upon him had the game broken Zapatero's way. And I certainly don't think you're wrong, but it always cracks me up to hear you talk about how underrated Mike Chisel is. So I'm saying Mike White was robbed. Dom is saying Mike Chisel was robbed. But anything else that you want to get to?
I am not kidding when I say that him going along with Zapatero throwing that third challenge of the entire game to vote out Russell may be a $1 million mistake. Like, I think that game was so scripted for the most part and so predictable that you can actually go back that far and map out the outcomes from there. And unless, you know, Rob or Grant maybe or some Ometepe just blitzes through everything from Redemption Island and then comes back and wins all the final challenges, which is going to be harder when you have Mike, especially there competing with them. I think Mike very easily wins that season and gets remembered as like the good twin of, you know, Brian Heideck or whatever.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap it up for us, I believe, this week here on the Mike Chisel Appreciation Hour. But thank you guys, of course, for continuing to support the show. We will talk to you next Saturday. Take care, everybody.